You're listening to the Quince Podcast.
In a very shocking and saddening incident from Assam, at least two people were reported dead in police firing and nine injured after violent clashes broke out on 23rd September during an eviction drive in Darang district. Disturbing videos of clashes between locals and police from the eviction drive that have surfaced online give a glimpse into unrestrained police brutality. One particular video that has drawn a lot of anger show policemen firing at locals of Sipajhar area when a lone local charges at them with a stick. And in this mayhem, he's then thrashed brutally by the police even as his body lay motionless. While this incident of violence has drawn a lot of reprobation from ordinary citizens, activists and politicians alike, the eviction drive itself is also raising a lot of questions. Over the past few months, the Assam government has embarked on an anti-encroachment drive that has rendered hundreds of people from socially and economically marginalized communities homeless. But unlike the previous eviction drives in the state, the recent one that began from 20th September is seen to be a far bigger exercise to clear 4,500 bighas of encroached land that, according to the Assam Chief Minister Himanta Biswa Sarma's own tweet, has left people from 800 households homeless. This raises a few questions. Firstly, with a large number of the displaced families being Muslims of Bengali origins, is the Assam government's anti-encroachment drive likely to heighten polarization in the state? Secondly, with a recent analytical report from the Housing and Land Rights Network, or HLRN, also pointing out that nearly 21 people were evicted every hour in the pandemic months between March 2020 and July 2021, what kind of a commentary do these evictions from Assam and other parts of India present on the lack of social security for the landless? How do these acts affect lives and livelihoods of marginalized people? Thirdly, how should authorities go about evictions without impinging on the dignity of living? What are the safeguards required to ensure that such drives don't leave people with nowhere to go? In this episode, you'll hear from Suraj Gogoi, PhD scholar of sociology at the National University of Singapore, Manish, a lawyer and researcher at the Center for Policy Research, and Mukta Joshi, legal associate at Land Conflict Watch, which is a network of researchers studying and reporting on ongoing land and natural resource conflicts across the country. You're tuned in to The Big Story, the podcast where we dissect the headline-making news for you. And I'm your host, Shorbury. Following the uproar over the disturbing incident of police brutality in Darang, the Assam government has ordered a judicial probe. Home and Political Department Secretary Deva Prasad Misra said that the government has decided that the inquiry would be conducted by a retired judge of the Guwahati High Court. A photographer identified as Bijay Shankar Bania, hired by the district administration to document the eviction drive, who was also seen pouncing on a motionless man and beating him up black and blue in a shocking video, was also arrested. But the big question is, what is this eviction drive being carried out for? One of the pledges made by the BJP in its Assam election manifesto was to remove what they perceive as, quote-unquote, illegal encroachers on government-owned grazing and forest lands and give the land to, quote-unquote, indigenous people of the state. And so after being re-elected to power in Assam, the Sarma government has embarked on an eviction drive. Since June this year, there have been several anti-encroachment eviction drives in Hojai, in Sonitpur, that have displaced a few hundred families. And after the first round of evictions, the Sarma government went further and gave its nod to form a committee to oversee the Gorkhuti project. Now, this project, which is being touted as an quote-unquote agricultural project, aims to utilize 77,000 bighas of government-owned land in Sipajhar for quote-unquote agricultural purposes. Since the government has alleged that most of this land has been encroached upon by illegal settlers of Bangladeshi origin, now they have given orders to free up the land. And that's how we come to the incident that took place in Darang. According to a report on Scroll, locals said that the administration served them an eviction notice late on the night of 22nd September. This led to protests over demands for rehabilitation the next day on 23rd September. While some reports quote locals saying that the police opened fire, other reports quoted the police's version that the locals attacked them with stones, forcing them to retaliate. But with this eviction drive being seen as the BJP's attempt to exploit the religious fault lines in Assam, Is this likely to increase the already existing polarization on ground? Suraj Gogoi, who hails from Assam and is also a PhD scholar of sociology at the National University of Singapore, weighs in.
It is said that identifying friend and enemy is a significant attribute of politics. The Bangladeshi has been the social enemy of the Assamese for a long time, in fact, for more than a century. The polarization that we see today has a life of its own, even without the BJP or the termite discourse. Bangladeshi communists and Pakistanis were long declared as the enemy of Assam and the Assamese. The enemy in the minds of the Assamese nationalist was very clear. A series of events such as language rights in 1960s, Assam movement, Nelly massacre in 1983, IMDT 2005, NRC are sufficient proof of how the social and political target in the form of the minority has been a constant feature of Assamese political life. Assamese nationalist, even liberal and self-proclaimed Marxist ones, would try to suggest that BJP has polarized and communalized Assam and that we have a history and heritage of secular culture. But to understand the polarization we see today, we must begin without the BJP and with the Assamese nationalist and nationalism. The entry of BJP certainly increases the attack on the minorities. They have capitalized on the existing hate. Their political strategy and organizing principle of hate and difference are not based on the same material and cultural interest of the caste Assamese. They might align with them, but are not the same. Their enemy might be the same, but they don't have the same origin. Misidentifying the perpetrator or difference between them muddles the victimhood and violence caused by nationalism and nationalists on the minority. To understand the victimhood of the Muslims in Assam, we must equally place our gauge on both the parties that enables such polarities.
He also points out how evictions increased in the state over the past years under the BJP rule.
Eviction drives have certainly increased since the BJP government came to power in Assam in 2016. Be it the Amchang eviction in 2017 or continuous evictions we see in Kaziranga, Nogaon in 2016 and now in Dorong. Collectively, the majority of the evicted people belong to the Muslim community. There is no denying this fact. The manner in which eviction drives are carried out has also become extremely violent. Yesterday's incident was extremely disturbing, to say the least. Most of the evicted have been victims of flood. They live in places known as chors or sorsaporis, as we call them in Assamese, which are found in riverine areas of the Brahmaputra Valley in Assam. These geographies are prone to flood, erosion, and all kinds of natural calamities and uncertainties. Their livelihood is tied to these geographies, which are sinking, flooded, and ephemeral. They do not colonize these geographies. They have in fact made them productive with minimum technology and introduced multiple cropping. Most of the vegetables that the urban middle class today enjoy in cities like Guwahati come from these geographies and from the labor of these people. This is the economic profile of the people who are evicted by the Assam government. The psychology of evicting them and support for such acts are socially found. So it is not just the matter of government's indulgence, but equally of Assamese nationalism, which seeks or sees these people as the enemy of the Assamese. Such hostility makes eviction socially desirable and legitimate at the same time.
But beyond the political undertones of this eviction drive, another important factor to look at here is the human cost of it all. Whatever the reason may be, political gains or otherwise, such acts impact the already economically and socially marginalized landless people. As a result of Sarma's eviction drive, hundreds of people who have been cultivating land in these areas of Assam for the past several decades suddenly have nowhere to go without a proper rehabilitation plan in place. But these questions of social security and rehabilitation doesn't just pertain to this specific incident from Assam. Rather, this is a part of a larger issue. If in Assam the drives are being carried out over quote-unquote agricultural projects, an analytical report from Housing and Land Rights Network also point out that in the year 2020, evictions were carried out for a whole range of reasons, including slum clearance, encroachment removal, city beautification drives, infrastructure and developmental projects, environmental projects, forest protection and wildlife conservation, disaster management efforts and other reasons such as political rallies and targeted discrimination. And the result of these eviction or demolition drives threw up some stark numbers. Even as India reeled under a pandemic, the HLRN report points out that more than 2,50,000 people in the country were evicted from their homes by authorities between March 2020 and July 2021. This means nearly 21 people were evicted every hour. Just between 1st January 2021 and 31st July 2021, state authorities across India demolished at least 24,445 homes, affecting over 1,69,000 people. Of these, about 13,750 people were evicted during the peak of the second wave and the resultant lockdowns in April and May 2021. So you get the picture. But what kind of a commentary does it all present on the lack of social security for the landless, underprivileged sections of the society? How do these evictions and demolition drives all over the country affect people's lives and livelihoods? Mukta Joshi, legal associate at Land Conflict Watch, weighs in.
First of all, land rights give people more than just title over property. They're a source of security, a source of dignity, and a means to a livelihood. Our constitution guarantees to all its citizens the right to life under Article 21, which includes not only the right to survive, but a life with dignity, which also includes the right to livelihood. The Supreme Court has also held that the right to adequate housing is a human right and a fundamental right to be read into Article 21. The constitution also guarantees protection from arbitrary state action under Article 14, which is the right to equality. And this is also the right routinely violated when forcible evictions are conducted without following basic due process. So I certainly believe that land rights are inherently tied to the fundamental rights our constitution grants us, and they need to be looked at through that lens as well. I think it's very important to understand that the people at greatest risk of eviction and demolitions are also some of the most marginalized people in the country, who live in settlements where their land rights are not formalized, not recognized, and who can easily be labeled as encroachers. So the impact that an eviction drive or demolition drive has is multiplied. It results in destruction of personal property, unregularized small businesses in these areas are also demolished with no alternative accommodation or alternative employment. I don't think it would be a stretch to say that communities whose settlements have been demolished are left with nothing.
Manish, a lawyer and researcher at the Center for Policy Research, further points out that often the people who are perceived as illegal encroachers by the state or courts and are subsequently evicted are victims of the state's failure to provide affordable housing for all. This is particularly the case behind some of the informal settlements in urban areas, he says, where migrants or daily wage labourers are forced to settle over the lack of affordable housing.
Yeah, so especially in urban areas, housing has been, and large urban areas in particular, housing has been a constraint. The availability of accessible, affordable housing, which a large section of the population needs. This has been, and governments have largely failed to provide for this housing. Right? In Delhi, for instance, our work at CPR has shown how the Delhi Development Authority, which was in charge of providing public housing, has systematically failed to meet its targets of providing affordable housing since 1957, right, over 60 years. Now, what this means is that people who come to the city for livelihood have to find a place to live, right? And then they end up being pushed into the informal market. Because both the market, the private real estate market, and the government don't provide them with any affordable housing. And the informal market is usually informal and affordable on account of being able to overcome the challenge of extensive land in our city. Right? So usually these are settlements that are located either on public land or sometimes on private land, settlements that have come up informally, that have been built by people from scratch, often on uninhabitable land, which has been made habitable by people working over years and decades to do them. Right? So you will find them, for instance, on the banks of Nalas. You will find settlements next to the railway tracks in like thorny and jungly kind of areas. In places that were otherwise considered uninhabited or wastelands are abandoned by the city, right? And then these people come and make it habitable, because that's literally the only place they have to live. So I think it helps to have this perspective about what about why people live in these settlements because of a lack of affordable housing. And then if you go to the root of that problem, then you will see that there is state failure, there is market failure in addressing that issue, right? And then therefore, when you come back to it legally, if you consider questions of justice, fairness, equity, the picture becomes a little more balanced, does it not?
Now, if you look at the reports of some of the other recent demolition drives in the country, in Delhi alone, there have been two big demolition drives this year. One in September, where the Faridabad District Administration began a demolition drive at Delhi NCR's Jamai Colony, which was situated on Aravali land. And then one more in July, where, acting on the orders of the Supreme Court, the Faridabad Municipal Corporation also demolished at least 12,000 houses belonging mostly to daily wage workers in Koregaon. Several weeks prior to the eviction, the authorities had also cut off water and electricity supply to the colony. Some residents who continue to live among the rubble of the demolished houses have reportedly asked for speedy rehabilitation, as they have nowhere to go. Now, looking at these reports, one might wonder, what about the right to live with dignity? Is there no legal protection there for marginalized landless people? Manish says that the link between livelihoods and housing have been constitutionally recognized for a long time in Indian jurisprudence and has been upheld in high courts around the country as well, but only in cases where the affected had the means to approach the court.
The link between livelihoods and housing has been constitutionally recognized for a long time in Indian jurisprudence. So in 1986, there was a famous case called Olga Tellis versus the state, where an activist, Olga Tellis, went before the Supreme Court asking for relief for some pavement dwellers in Bombay who were thought to be evicted by the municipality in the middle of the monsoon. And the court held that even the pavement dwellers were guaranteed with the right to life under Article 21, which has been read by the Supreme Court to include not just sort of basic existence, but also the right to a dignified life, which includes many aspects such as livelihood. And the court held that to displace them suddenly without notice would be in violation of this right, and directed that there was a basic minimum of procedural fairness that had to be shown to them, even if they were occupying public space or public land, which was the corporation's argument. This has been upheld by some high courts around the country, but this is all of this has happened in cases where the affected parties have actually gone to court and claimed their rights. And in many cases of eviction and demolition, those affected are always the poorest, most marginalized people belonging to marginalized groups in society.
But with most of the affected people hailing from marginalized communities, a majority of them don't have the access to seek help and claim rehabilitation. As a result, the HLRN report also points out that an overwhelming majority of people evicted in 2020 did not receive any kind of rehabilitation from the government. Resettlement or partial resettlement or some amount of compensation was provided in only 13% of the documented cases of eviction in 2020 for which information is available. Mukta Joshi also elaborates more about this problem.
There are a number of legislations under which evictions are carried out. Even these legislations, which are completely inadequate in terms of procedural protection during the actual eviction or rehabilitation, for example, even these legislations contain the principles of basic due process, which include a prior notice of eviction, the opportunity for the occupant to be heard, and for there to be a fair decision-making process to determine whether the eviction is even to take place. Our data shows that this basic due process is also routinely violated. So, from the Land Conflict Watch database, it can be seen that complaints against procedural violations have been made by affected communities in over 41% of conflicts where forced evictions have taken place. If these due process safeguards were designed in a meaningful manner, ensuring that prior notice is given, that the occupants have the option of adequate representation at the hearing, it would go a long way in easing the very real harm that is caused by the constant looming threat of evictions.
So now, given all these factors, what kind of safeguards are necessary to ensure that affected people don't have their social security snatched away due to evictions and demolitions? Manish says that while legal networks do provide assistance to affected people, eviction should be a last resort.
So the safeguards sometimes come from the courts. And at DHRTF, lawyers who've been associated with the task force and organizations have gone to court representing people from these bastis. Often there is very little clear communication from the government. So sometimes, residents will just wake up one day to find like eviction notices pasted outside their doors. Those are the lucky ones.
Yeah.
There have been instances where like they have woken up to bulldozers at their door.
Hmm.
The ones who receive notices through these networks, often do approach courts, and then the Delhi High Court at least has been fairly good at implementing the policy. So as long as you are able to show that these are residents to whom the policy is applicable, and this is a notified added process, and therefore they're eligible, the court will issue a stay order asking the government to carry out the survey and rehabilitation process before the eviction. The larger question, to answer the larger question, I think I think it depends largely on the initiatives of the government.
Mm.
So a government that is humanitarian, a government that is kind, and a government that sees the residents of these people, of these places, as equal citizens, will take that into consideration. And we often say eviction should be a last resort.
Adding to what Manish points out, Mukta Joshi also says that our laws need to reflect the fundamental right to adequate housing.
I think the biggest step in terms of assuring dignity of living would be to ensure that our laws reflect the fundamental right to adequate housing. This would include the regularization of settlements and recognition of land rights of these communities, and in instances where that is challenging for environmental reasons, for example, to ensure that meaningful rehabilitation is provided. So there's a set of guidelines on development-based evictions that's been prepared by the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing. And these guidelines include principles that are entirely missing from Indian law, which would actually go a long way to ensure that evictions only take place when absolutely necessary, that due process is followed, that the eviction itself is conducted in a humane manner, and that restitution and voluntary return are options to the affected communities, and that adequate rehabilitation is done. I think the biggest problem in how these legislations have been framed is the dehumanization of people and communities on the receiving end of evictions. And I think that's why it's most important to view both land rights and the lack of land rights on an equal pedestal to all human rights.
And that's a wrap for this episode, but do stay tuned to The Big Story. If you like listening to this episode, please subscribe to The Big Story playlist for episodic updates. We'll have on Apple, Google Podcast, Spotify, JioSaavn, and most of the other popular podcast streaming platforms. For other podcasts, please log on to the Quinn website and check out the podcast section. For any feedback, shoot an email to podcasts@thequinn.com.
Thanks for listening. Log on to the Quinn's website and check out our other podcasts.